Okay, we're back for episode 109 of Powers and Principalities. Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. Such a pleasure to be here with you tonight.
Good to talk to you, too. Well, tonight, I think you suggested we talk about the late Gary Webb. The story he broke, of course, that name is familiar for many people in the alternative media. Gary Webb was an American journalist best known for his Dark Alliance series, in which he investigated the role of the Contras in the CIA in the crack cocaine explosion in American cities, especially Los Angeles, California. In the 1980s, Webb, an investigative journalist for the San Jose Mercury News, uncovered convincing evidence that proceeds from international cocaine trafficking represented a major source of funding for the U.S.-backed rebel guerrilla fighters in Nicaragua known as the Contras, with South Central Los Angeles and other urban African-American communities serving as key markets for the drug, and more distressing that the CIA had become aware of this illicit commerce early on and incorporated into a broader domestic strategy, allowing the cocaine pipeline to continue and thrive to a massive degree that eventually gave rise to the U.S. crack epidemic of the 1980s and the 90s and the birth of the prison industrial sector. Webb personally interviewed alleged drug merchant government agent Oscar Danilo Blandón, and many other central players, traveling as far as Nicaragua to speak with drug lord Norin Menezes in Los Angeles to meet with infamous crack cocaine entrepreneur Freeway Ricky Ross. Webb made his primary source materials, including the CIA documents and audio tape interviews he quoted, available online for anyone to download and review. Nonetheless, the press and the CIA took advantage of the fact that in the mid-1990s, the vast majority of Americans were not yet savvy surfers of the internet. Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the Crack Cocaine Explosion is a 1998 book by Gary Webb. The book is based on, of course, the three-part Dark Alliance series in the San Jose Mercury News. Of course, Gary Webb's claims in Dark Alliance were stunning and bold. For a better part of a decade, the San Francisco Bay Area drug ring sold tons of cocaine to Crips and Bloods street gangs of Los Angeles and funneled millions in drug profits to a Latin American guerrilla army run by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, the Mercury News investigation has found. This drug network opened the first pipeline between Colombia's cocaine cartels and the black neighborhoods of Los Angeles, a city now known as the crack capital of the world. The cocaine that flooded in helped spark a crack explosion in urban America and provided the cash and connections needed for LA's gangs to buy automatic weapons. Thousands of young black men are serving long prison sentences for selling cocaine, a drug that was virtually unobtainable in black neighborhoods before the members of the CIA started bringing it into South Central in the 1980s at bargain basement prices. Now, according to Nicholas Dumovic, a CIA director of intelligence staffer who wrote an internal report on Web series, pointed out that much of what was reported in Dark Alliance was in fact not new. As early as 1985, the Associated Press journalist Robert Perry and Brian Barger found that the Contra groups had engaged in cocaine trafficking in part to help finance the war against Nicaragua. A special Senate subcommittee chaired by then-Senator John Kerry investigated the AP's findings and in 1989 released a 1,166-page report on covert U.S. operations throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. The subcommittee report stated, on the basis of evidence, it is clear that individuals who provided support for the Contras were involved in drug trafficking. The supply network of the Contras was used by drug trafficking organizations. Elements of the Contras themselves knowingly received financial material assistance from drug traffickers. In each case, one or another agency of the U.S. government had information regarding the involvement of either while it was occurring or immediately thereafter. Of course, when the story broke, Gary Webb was became a very well-known name, but immediately the media turned on him. Eventually, the media would try to discredit him. Most notably, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times ran articles calling his allegations unfounded. The LA Times devoted no less than 17 reporters to the Get Gary Webb program they had going on there. The Mercury News, who originally stood by Gary Webb's reporting, complied with these new denunciations and published an apology for the series in May of 1997. Gary, I think Gary Webb was then sent to a smaller office 100 miles away from where he lived, and he was eventually sort of shuffled out of investigative journalism. 2 years later, Gary Webb's own story would become a subject of a biography written by award-winning. Oh, I'm sorry. This came. Of course, Webb's career was ruined, and ultimately his life was. His marriage broke up, and in 2004, the journalist was found dead in his house with two 38 caliber bullets to his head from an apparent suicide. It was ruled a suicide, shot twice in the head. 2 years later, Gary Webb's own story would become a subject of a biography written by an award-winning investigative journalist, Nick Shue, who also worked as an consultant on the 2014 film of the same name, Kill the Messenger. The film was a depiction of Webb's life starring Jeremy Renner. So that's kind of a rundown of what Gary Webb went through. We can go get into his suicide and, of course, how the CIA coordinated the media attack and what he unearthed, or what he at least publicized or exposed, made more well known about CIA and drug trafficking and the role of drugs, not only in international politics, geopolitics, but also in social engineering. I'm sure you have something to offer there, Joe.
I hope so. I've actually was researching Gary Webb this week because I think this is kind of an anniversary of his either the article or his death. I don't know why it came across my like internet activity feed as this was kind of Gary Webb's moment, an anniversary of some sort. I forget what it was. I wish I had my memory, but I don't. Anyway, so I suggested we talk about him, and I often cite Webb because we have done a couple of shows on the destruction of the black family, the African American family, how it's been targeted and destroyed. And this actually, the show tonight will be almost like a trilogy with the Martin Luther King show that we did, where we kind of exposed the Masonic, workers' paradise of integration that was, given to the African American community at the same time, with the, you know, with in conjunction with the stuff we showed in the show we did on the Great Society, where you had deliberately crafted social programs and welfare systems that were created to shatter the black family. And so then when you come to Gary Webb, he shows that the CIA was involved in the creation of sort of the cocaine problem in the United States. Webb was basically attacked on the grounds that his case was circumstantial, that he couldn't absolutely prove that there, that the CIA had ordered these things, and arguments were developed of kind of how the CIA was just a bad person in a tough world that was using bad people who were already doing stuff. There's different ways that they kind of went at Webb's analysis, but the fact is that first, Webb is very historically significant because really the alt media begins with his posting of the documents that supported his argument. I mean, that is the moment. Gary Webb, he said, look, here we are in San Jose. He worked for the San Jose Mercury News. He goes, San Jose is like a internet town where we've got, all these internet companies and stuff. Let's take advantage of it. And we will post the documentation of the story. And Webb said that he wanted to do this because the story was so sensational that he felt it needed extraordinary evidence, and he wanted to be able to have people just go right to the documentation. So he did. When he brought out what became the Dark Alliance book, he brought them out in a series of articles in the San Jose Mercury News in 96. He would post at a website and give the links in the article that people could go, and they could go through the collection of the declassified documents that he had obtained through FOIA, which were basically the evidence that there was collusion and knowledge of drug, you know, trafficking that the CIA was involved with, and money being paid back to the Contras. Now you then had the John Kerry committee report, which, you know, kind of was a limited hangout thing that said, hey, you know, Webb was, his ideas were kind of right. But even there, you know, the statement was that you know, that it was there was no arrest. There was just this idea that there that this was, you know, kind of a tough, immoral behavior, and we were fighting the commies, gosh darn it, you know. And so we had to do this stuff in order to get money to the Contras. And the whole thing was is that the Congress had shut down the funding of the Contras, so supposedly Bush is hamstringed, Reagan is hamstringed, Bush is hamstringed. They can't really use overt money to fund these guys, and so the cocaine money that they were making was the you know, the solution to this. And that's kind of what Webb brought forward. Okay, now sadly, Webb simply, for a number of reasons, didn't understand what actually the operation was. In fact, the I would argue that the Contras were a, you know, a controlled opposition. If you look at Daniel Ortega, go into his background, you can see that he claims to have learned how to fight in the Masonic Temple. And he was a follower of Sandino. The Sandinistas are named after this guy. Sandino, he gets August Sandino. He brings what's called Mexican Freemasonry to Nicaragua, which is a, you know, very, you know, just nothing special. But this is the basis of the of this Contra struggle. It's a Masonic, you know, where both sides are, I think, are being manipulated kind of deal. And so what really was the purpose of the CIA's activity, this, in terms of getting the cocaine in? I mean, we know that, you know, they would have access to any kind of money they want. They can use all sorts of black box money. They don't have to do it this way. Why are this whole elaborate story being brought out? And then, you know, Webb was you know, involved in bringing a lot of it to light. What was the purpose of this? Well, it was because they wanted basically a way to bring the cocaine into the black neighborhoods. And this is really what the CIA was doing. And since they had to have some explanation for that, this the Contra funding was there was the rationale that basically was then brought to the public. But the fact is that it really was the whole thing was done to create the what's called the crack cocaine epidemic. Now, you know, cocaine has been around for 1,000 years or, you know, more. It had never produced the kind of psychosis that was found with the crack smokers that first started in Los Angeles. But that was because it was either it was taken in other sort ways. It was either the leaves were chewed, which was the normal Indian method, or you could basically break it down and distill it and make it into a powder. And this was what was brought to the United States in the late 60s and early 70s. Very expensive.
Yeah, it was the type of stuff that you found in California and that the Eagles would sing about in Life in the
Exactly.
Fast Lane.
Life in the Fast Lane. And it was like $150 for a gram.
Yeah.
But that all went away, or at least was replaced
You
by the crack.
snorted at parties hanging out with Stevie Nicks and
Yeah.
Lindsey Buckingham, yeah, in the 70s,
Yeah,
yeah.
that's right. Exactly right. So this was cocaine. But anyway, what had happened was we had this project MK Ultra, which was trying to find ways to basically debase human psychology. It was, I mean, if you look at a lot of the projects, they're really trying to find ways to subtract the soul from the human being. One of the ones that's very famous because it implicates Aldous Huxley, and I'll be talking about that later on, is that Huxley gave instructions to Humphrey or Osmond, I think his name is, to go to this guy Jolly West. And he said, tell West, and he was doing human LSD experiments. He says, I want West to do hypnosis on these individuals. Give them LSD after the hypnotism and see if they would then be more readily compliant to the instructions that the hypnosis was told them to do.
He's the one that killed the elephant, right?
Yeah, Jolly West. Now, he is, we could go like for hours on Jolly yeah. West. Basically, he is like the real Dr. Mengele. He was involved in using cattle prods on children. I mean, there is just no kind of bar of morality that is too low for this serpent. He is just, you know, human experiments are just right and left. And notice, even in the famous one with Huxley, which was to digress, was very important because, see, Huxley had written Brave New World, and he went on Mike Wallace in this interview saying, hey, we got to be careful about the government getting, like, technical control over human beings. But this is all a lie, you know, his public stance, because if you look at the suggestion to Jolly West, it is specifically the control for government that he was claiming to be warning people about, right? He's actually saying, you know, hypnotize the guy, give him some instructions, and then dose him with LSD, and let's see if he follows the orders like a robot. So Huxley is a dirty lifetime actor, and he used Jolly West. I won't go into West too deep here. I know a lot about this serpent, but West is not his real name, Tim. In fact, no one knows his real name. Comes from a Jewish family. They immigrated from Russia. He was born in Brooklyn and then went to the University of Oklahoma. And the first thing you know, he's conducting human experiments with LSD and for MK Ultra. So he then, in 1969, when MK Ultra is in full throttle, he goes to UCLA to head what's called the Neuropsychiatric Institute. And there, the MK Ultra doctor was in charge of an individual named Ron Siegel, who I will talk about in a little, Dr. Ron Siegel. Now, Siegel is a do what thou wilt guy. He is, he writes books telling people that drugs are fine, cocaine is fine, that there's a drive in the human spirit to find pleasure, and drugs are just a natural outgrowth of this. He went in front of Congress and he said that, that really the advantages of cocaine outweigh any problem, right? So he actually made these statements, and was, he's kind of this Dr. Feelgood guy, but he worked with Jolly West at the Neuropsychiatric Institute, which is actually just a fairly small building. I have a picture of it here I'm looking at. But years later, he was interviewed, and the interview is simply one of the most important ones I think is available on the internet, and I'm going to actually play it. I wanted to give the citation. I got it from Jay Love. He posted it as a YouTube video, and I'm going to post a link to the show on Jay Love's his YouTube posting, because I want him to hear what we've done, and I'm hoping to get feedback from him. But anyway, I want to play this interview. And this was done years after the crack cocaine. You'll hear this, but it is an interview with Dr. Ronald Siegel, the employee of Jolly West. Here we go.
We're in touch with a lot of the underground chemists who are synthesizing new compounds, and they send a lot of them to us for testing. We don't give them any feedback, but we like to monitor what's out there in the street. And by the way, our lab was the one who discovered the crack epidemic, and we discovered crack 13 years before the word was even introduced into the lexicon. We had monkeys smoking crack cocaine in the basement labs at UCLA 13 years before the word was invented, because we knew it was coming. and we wanted to make sure that we understood everything. We're working on the next ones already. Drugs that are out there now on the street that are not illegal, that people are looking at.
And again, you're at UCLA?
Yes.
Yeah. Just yeah. to let listeners know, yeah, where you're speaking from.
Yes, I've been here for a long, long time. I came out here from New York because I came out here because it was one of the few places I could do LSD research at the time, and we were giving LSD and all kinds of marijuana and all kinds of other drugs to volunteers in the laboratory. And I wanted to move away from animal research and move into people who could give informed consent and volitionally agree to all the conditions of the experiments. And it was also an exciting time because lots of new epidemics have started here in California. The psychedelic revolution started here. The methamphetamine epidemic in 69-70 started here. The crack epidemic in the form of cocaine-free base smoking started here in 19... 19-
I know this is kind of going to drive some people crazy, but Tim, I just want to play a little bit of it over again because it's so important for people to hear it, because the dates are important. I'll show why in a second. But anyway, here's the beginning of the interview again with Ronald K. Siegel, the employee of Jolly West, the Dr. Mengele of MK Ultra. So here, listen to what he has to say.
We're in touch with a lot of the underground chemists who are synthesizing new compounds, and they send a lot of it to us for testing. We don't give them any feedback, but we like to monitor what's out there in the street. And by the way, our lab was the one who discovered the crack epidemic, and we discovered crack 13 years before the word was even introduced into the lexicon. We had monkeys smoking crack cocaine in the basement labs at UCLA 13 years before the word was invented.
Okay, Now this is, this just couldn't be more important because, you see, after Siegel's experiments with the monkeys at UCLA, and bear in mind, of course, Jolly West is the guy who killed the elephant with the LSD overdose, right? Jolly is Siegel's boss, is famous for, you know, killing Tosca the elephant. But by the way, Siegel, this character, then also gave LSD to elephants. Fortunately, these two pachyderms lived. But, so you can get senses like the moral, kind of breadth of these characters. Siegel was also giving LSD to elephants. Now, anyway, so Siegel, when he appeared before a Congress, he was well aware of the effects of crack cocaine, because what he's talking about is 1971. And he then went to Congress in the late 70s saying that, we don't really have anything to worry about in terms of cocaine because it's really expensive and also it doesn't really do any damage. So now crack is, basically, what they discovered, and now just to back up a second, in 69, when Jolly West took over the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute, MKUltra is still in full throttle, and cocaine is one of the primary drugs they're studying, trying to figure out how to get the soul out of a human being so they can become robots. So these experiments that they were doing on cocaine were not basically trying to, achieve the effect of, at a party with Stevie Nicks where, you see if she'll smoke dope with you in the car or something. I mean, they had done something different with cocaine. And what they had done was something they'd never done before. It was done here for the first time in the UCLA Neuropsychiatric. They basically reduce cocaine to something which was flammable, because they wanted to see if the smoke had a more potent effect than the sniffing of it. And it turned out it was like 100 times stronger. It was incredible how strong the effect was. Evidently, the lungs were perfectly designed to take in the vapor and to get this stuff. It was almost as strong as the intravenous. And so the fact is that when Siegel knows about this. I mean, they're actually the ones who are developing it. But moreover, Siegel was also aware of the first implementation of the smoking. And this wasn't in the United States. People think it was. It wasn't. They actually had done experiments with smoking cocaine in South America. And so what they found was that even though cocaine had been known in Peru and Bolivia for thousands of years, there was really almost no reports of any serious medical effects from it. However, once they understood that reducing it to a smoking compound would be valuable, they did their first experiments in South America. And what they did was they created a what was called a Borrasco, which is basically just the base of the cocaine. In other words, they didn't take it to powder because that was hard to burn and to turn into vapor. And so psychiatrists suddenly began reporting that there were individuals who were basically breaking down psychologically. They said that there were asylums filling up, like there were just these half mad drug fiends. One of the Bolivian, he said that they had visual hallucinations. They bore scratches from trying to dig out the hallucinations they felt crawling under their skin. So basically, and this was in like the mid 70s. Okay, now. So what happens is they develop it at UCLA. They then take it to through the CIA assets in Colombia and Peru, and they experiment with it there, and they see, yeah, this is just terrific. And then the next thing you know, you have the crack epidemic in the United States. Now, in the United States, this base that they were smoking in South America is very hard to transport. It's gooey. It's easier to transport the powder, mm-hmm. but they would reconvert it to crack. They would mix it with either ammonia and with baking soda, heat mm-hmm. it. It would become a fluid. They would get all of the material out. What would be left would be something that could actually be vaporized, unlike the powder. And so this then exploded on the LA scene. This is Freeway Ricky Ross, and suddenly in the early 80s, basically, the homicide rate for black males between 14 and 17 more than doubled. The homicide rate for black males aged 18 to 24 tripled. Okay. During this period, the black community experienced a 100% increase in fetal death rates, low birth rate babies, weapons arrest, and numbers of children in foster care. Okay, so this is a 1-2 punch because remember, 15 years early, you have the Great Society. Okay, you're getting the family disconnected. The males are moving out. Woman is becoming the sole parent. The welfare checks are coming in. There's dependency upon the state. The children are not experiencing a father. Now, this group is then these young males, the ones we're talking about in these statistics, are now being exposed to crack cocaine. Okay, now, there are so many things to talk about, but the one thing I want to mention is that Gary Webb, he then posted, documents saying, look, we can show the CIA is involved here. And it's when you look at all this in context, you can see that the cocaine funding of the Contras is nonsense. This is the black family is the target, because there was this character who was famous, Freeway Ricky Ross, you know, selling $1 million a week worth of cocaine. He's working with a guy named Blandone. Mm-hmm. So he's the one who actually brings the cocaine into the United States. There's a guy named...
Blandone is actually directly tied to the agency.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, and now here's where you get the other side of the, you know, what I call the...
Well, first, let me get you talked about this Ronald Siegel, who's talking about how they developed crack... They developed the method of refining or breaking cocaine into crack cocaine at UCLA in the 1970s. Did I have that correct?
Yeah, 71, yeah.
It's 1971. So this is perfected at the university, UCLA, at the
the Neuropsychiatric Institute that was run by Jolly West.
Jolly West. So, and I mean, the impression a lot of people have is that what happened was the method of doing this was discovered on the street, and therefore cocaine became available to poor people in this highly addictive, powerful, medium, crack cocaine. And so then
it makes no mathematical sense. We'll get into the finances and back of all this.
But what I'm saying is the method for making crack cocaine was developed at a university, and I guess the suggestion is then that the ways for doing it was then transferred to the street, so the so-called underground chemist could make it.
Well, okay, so that was kind of the claim, and this is what Webb could see. The CIA was around, and he was thinking, look, this money's getting back, it's for the Contras. Mm-hmm. And he was accusing the CIA of basically immoral behavior because he said, look, there's so many of the people who are using the drug are blacks. But bear in mind, the thing that was actually supporting, you can see how insidious the whole plan is that there's all of these white baby boomers that love cocaine. Mm-hmm. They're not smoking crack. Crack is not being released into bourgeois middle-class society. The amount of like even like Latinos relative to African-Americans, 100 to 1. 100 to 1, mm-hmm. Right? Okay, so that's not being released into these communities. It is being controlled, and they're attacking the children, basically, of the Great Society program.
And if I'm not mistaken, a lot of the proceeds were then funneled into, like, Death Row Records.
It goes everywhere imaginable. Yeah. Death Row, of course, all of these. Yeah. The whole culture starts to disassemble and head toward, basically, criminality. They're being driven there. But the other part of the other analytic structure, which Webb got, but because he didn't understand he didn't understand MK Ultra, he didn't understand Great Society, so he's just seeing basically the plan as they are using it, and they knew that they could get caught, so they got this whole weird Contra thing that they can fall back on and it's a limited hangout. But you can see the CIA is involved because Blandone is actually working with Ricky Ross, and Ross reported that very often he would be told, you know, don't go to this house, don't go here. He was never arrested, and he was able to conduct business for like 5 years. And this, and also he set up a distribution network so that in Los Angeles and then in New York, in these black communities, crack cocaine was starting to just pour in. Okay, now, how do we know that this is a that the crack specifically is a is a government project? Because Freeway Ricky Ross, and the reason that he was selected is because he's totally illiterate, can't read or write. Okay, and he's also arithmetically illiterate. So the idea of him like running this $500 million empire is ludicrous, but he just was a puppet who was basically told what to do and then protected. And this is stuff that Webb got. But the way you can absolutely be certain that the CIA was orchestrating it, and incidentally, you know, we use the term CIA, but that's one of the problems, is that it isn't the CIA. The CIA is part of it. It's the secret society. They can be outside the CIA anytime they want. When Webb thought he was dealing with an agency that had gone rogue, But this isn't what you're dealing with. You're dealing with a secret society. You're dealing with a society that was overarching our government, and it can use anything it wants, and it can create money wherever it wants. It controls the media. We'll get into that, I'm sure, mm-hmm. in a second. But you can definitely see that there is precision in terms of the introduction of crack cocaine, and that the CIA, as well as obviously its instructors, the secret society, was involved because you had Blandone's handler was Frank Lister. Now, Lister, like Siegel, is just absolutely critical to understand, you know, because he had, during this entire time, he was in touch with, and these phone records are part of what Gary Webb produced. He was in touch with, on a bi-monthly basis, with Bill Nelson. Bill Nelson. And Nelson had recently created what's called a floor, F-L-U-O-R. It was sort of a precursor to Blackwater. It's a, you know, like a Praetorian Guard kind of thing. You know, it's like it represents itself as intelligence for governments and things. But
contracting firm, yeah, it does.
So Lister, who is the both bodyguard and, you know, like a handler of Blandone, who is bringing the cocaine in, and is working with him to manage Ricky Ross, and none of this is even contestable because of the great work of Gary Webb. We documented all this. He is in touch with Bill Nelson. Now, this is where you can see it. Because who is Nelson? Nelson had been the director of what's called the National Clandestine Services of the Central Intelligence Agency. He was held that position, which incidentally before him had been held by Helms, Donovan, and William Colby was his immediate predecessor. But he held this during the entire time the last half of MK Ultra. He left it for this strange situation. When people wondered why did he leave this incredibly powerful position to then work for Floor Corporation. Well, you can see now, you know, in context, that actually he just continued his role. What's called the National Clandestine Services, which controls like 60-70% of the CIA's budget, it's the most powerful person in the CIA, was this Bill Nelson. And then he transitions to Floor, which was in Los Angeles. And this is the guy that Lister would then meet with twice a month. And of course, you know, so you can now see the overall structure of the plan.
This is like Permadex Corporation and the JFK assassination. Yeah, this is how these connections to someone like, some of these figures aren't directly related to the agency, but they work for these cutouts or front operations.
So
Permadex ties back to the Israeli connection.
And so you've got, you have the John Kerry, his commission is what investigates Gary Webb's, basically the accusation that Webb's created. Kerry does a limited hangout. John Kerry, Skull and Bones guy, 100% a secret society member.
Yeah, he makes the rogue government argument, rogue agency argument.
And so this is the fallback position, is that, well, there's this rogue agency, there's these tough anti-communists that they're really cowboys and they mean well, but gee, gosh darn it, this time they...
It's a tough world.
That's there's hundreds of different ways you can go from here, but I just wanted to get that piece out because I think it's important to look at the thing in context, to look at Webb's information in the context of MK Ultra, seeing Jolly West basically being the individual who's producing and creating crack cocaine. Seeing the sophistry by Siegel to keep Congress from doing anything about.
Well, one thing is that they're not looking at the fact that universities are being utilized to proliferate drug use in society. And at the same time, this is tied to MKUltra, which, again, used hundreds of universities and corporations and, you know, cutouts and front groups and things like that to. And it's interesting he would talk about, this guy Ronald Siegel talk about how we were in contact with some of the underground chemists.
Yeah.
You know, well, yeah, and that's, this is, you know, you maintain relationships with drug dealers on the street, and because that's how you distribute it. But that pretty much is an admission of what Gary Webb was accusing CIA of doing. I find it interesting that throughout history, the justification for these things have always been wars or crises, geopolitical, international, national security crises or problems. Because as early as World War II, you had the Luciano Project, you know, where Lucky Luciano was released from prison. Governor Dewey did that for the War Department because he was supposedly going to help the Allied war effort in Italy and Sicily during that invasion. Used more or less, you know, La Cosa Nostra mafia connections in Sicily to fight the fascist government. And then after the war, this type of arrangement was maintained because of the Cold War and how, you know, Luciano was given more or less the French connection, where the drugs came out of Turkey and then going out of Marseille into New York, ultimately into New York City, the heroin. Because those funds were used, or his organization was used to fight the communists in Italy. And of course, then we have in Asia, you have the Kuomintang, the fall of the nationalist government, and how remnant forces in the Golden Triangle and also Chiang Kai-shek's government were funded by the opium trade, the heroin trade after World War II. And this goes back to the Flying Tigers and Claire Chennault, even the 1930s. These games, but the Vietnam War, you have, you know, the Planet of Jars, the Hmong people, they were fighting CIA's secret war in Laos and Cambodia, and that war was largely funded by the drug trade, because the Hmong, I think it was Vang Pao, was paid with heroin, refined heroin, and this I suppose this required like the conversion of a Pepsi bottling factory there, and then planes had to be flown in. These planes, actually special small planes, were designed that could land on small running strips that the CIA had developed, so they could fly supplies out, meaning, you know, yeah, right, Air America, you know, civil air transport, then Air America. These proprietary airline operations that were fronts for the CIA were established to fly the drugs and others, I guess, the money out. And this created networks of heroin going into Mexico. The money, a lot of the money there was then eventually found its way into Las Vegas and laundered there. In the 1960s, I think after the fall of Cuba, you had the development of, in the Bahamas, with Mary Carter Paint Company, the Castle Bank, and this involves the Vatican too, the Vatican Bank. But of course, Mary Carter Paint Company eventually becomes Resorts International, which eventually is bought out by Donald Trump.
Isn't that funny?
So this is how extensive. So I don't know how someone can look at Gary Webb's work and go, oh, this is outrageous, when just the basic survey of history goes, there's a vast network of drugs, money that define not only the economy but even the politics of nations and the geopolitics. I mean, it's like, who are you kidding here?
Yeah, absolutely. And then just one little last thing about that. So the black family was obviously targeted, and of course now when you've got crack cocaine, you have the mental institutions are overwhelmed, right? Mm-hmm. But so are the prisons.
Ah, but there's money to be made there, isn't there?
Well, yeah. Well, Congress passed a law in 86, which basically created a 100-to-1 sentencing disparity for the possession of crack. Mm-hmm. Now, why would they do this? Well, so, you know, white guys who are with Stevie Nicks in a Ferrari, they may get like a hand slap and, suspended sentence. But the kid on the street who's selling crack, he's going to be in prison for years. Mm-hmm. Right. And you see, well, what's the purpose of this? You know, they had created a law. Now it's still in effect, where for 5 grams of crack, the minimum mandatory sentence is 5 years. Now, you can have 500 grams of powder, and have the that would be when you'd get this sentence. So anyway, the 101 ratio created a lot of it created a lot of prison time for young black males, and this was obvious, in my opinion, kind of the last piece of the puzzle to make sure that the black family had no chance. Because now you've separated the males. You've got, particularly when they're in prison, when they get out, what can they do? You know, the idea of like family is just, you know, the only thing that can really work now is gangs. And of course, you've got like Death Row Records, right? Yeah. Glamorizing rap music and thug gang life. And so now.
And wasn't this also when they were privatizing prisons?
Yes, exactly. It had to because they couldn't. There wasn't enough government money to build them.
But it turns out that apparently the prison industrial complex, the privatized prisons, spend like 10 or 20 to 1 per prisoner than the government.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, just to see people, they have this idea, and this has been, you know, the media has helped create this, that you have a criminality at this high level in African Americans. Mm-hmm. And there's an enormously high level, but it's related to crack cocaine, because in 2000, the number of incarcerated African Americans was 26 times the amount it had been in 83, and 90% of imprisonment was for crack. Mm-hmm. So you can see that MK Ultra,
which was developed at UCLA.
It was developed by Jolly West. Yeah. Jolly West was he ran. He was the one who became head in 69 of the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute. And that's when human experimentation, you listen to Siegel's comments, mm-hmm. just clear as a bell. But also that's when, and you see the idea that West would have been experimenting with drugs for the idea of mind control. Tim, it's just axiomatic. The guy has been doing this for the last 10 years. That's why they brought him to UCLA. He was the MKUltra. He was one of the most outed guys. Now, there, he also had Sidney Cohen. He's the other LSD guy who you see, if you ever see the conversation on LSD with Tim Leary. He's the, you know, he's one of these guys who's asking fake questions, you know, he's this. But anyway, so it is a cesspool, MKUltra cesspool, UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute, run by Jolly West, who, as I said, is just a 100% Dr. Mengele plus, right? And the idea that they would have been looking at cocaine to see if there was something more to the drug is absolutely automatic, because they've been doing this all along. West had been involved. That's why, I mean, just think of the experiment that the Huxley set up, where you would give the hypnosis to an LSD patient to see if you could get control, right? This is what MKUltra's hidden purpose was. You know, you have lots of different things that, you know, they're saying, well, we're trying to develop robotic soldiers, you know, all the Manchurian candidate.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but this is all nonsense. They're just looking for ways to control the population.
Yeah, this is why they would, you know, they would utilize the Grateful Dead to promote LSD.
100%. And see, so this is why when you listen to Siegel, just absolutely being proud of the fact that they were developing it 13 years before the word crack had even existed. You know, there isn't any chance. See, this is
well, what gets me is it's not as if at the time there was a problem of crack cocaine out on the streets, so therefore you could say there's some sort of research was in order to develop its effects, to counteract it, to fight it, combat it. They're creating it.
Of course. It had never been. I mean, if you look at the history of cocaine in South America, there are no examples that you can find of, like, people having mental breakdowns. They were experimenting with the drug to see if there was more there in terms of social control. They hit the jackpot. MKUltra hit the jackpot, Tim. They found that, man, if we could just get the cocaine into a flammable condition, vaporize it, and get that stuff into the lungs, we just shut down the consciousness. We take the soul right out of the human being. They discovered it there. They then managed Ricky Ross to get this thing, once they had it all the technology worked out, everywhere. everywhere inside the African American community. It was given to the children of the Great Society program. Because, see, without a father, they were the most vulnerable. And, of course, remember, the whole thing is they're going to create a super debased culture that they're going to shove the remnants of the middle class into with integration.
Well, they've done that also with, you could say the middle class, upper middle class, have been targeted in other ways. One thing is sort of with the epidemic of prescription drugs.
Of course. Well, see, and Siegel was saying that. He was going, hey, we got the other stuff there, too. It's all coming down the line. I mean, so there it is.
I mean, a quarter of college students are on psychotropic drugs.
Oh, I think it's far more than that. I mean, that's what they admit to. But, I mean, like when my kids were in school, you know, and I actually children that I've known who have college court students have told me this, that if you don't feel well, you just go to the college. They have like a medical center.
Yeah.
And they will prescribe Adderall and Prozac to any single person who walks in.
Yes,
you don't get turned down.
If you're a freshman and you say, I have trouble organizing my schedule, being disciplined, well, you have attention deficit disorder. Here's some Adderall.
Exactly.
It might not be, you're just not disciplined. You've never been away from home, never been required to organize your day. You've always been lived in a structured environment. Now you're freer and you're feeling anxiety and you can't deal with it. They give you a freaking drug instead of saying, no, this is it. This is, you got to be more mature, manage your time, and maybe you're not ready for this yet. But no, they want you paying the tuition. At the same time, they'll fill you up. They'll give you your fix,
Yep. And so anyway, so that's why I took the liberty of taking this incredible interview that was discovered by J Love, and incidentally, it's published on YouTube. But you'd listen to the whole thing.
Well, I just want to know what legally valid reasons a college professor or researcher has with maintaining communications with underground chemists who have to be doing something illegal.
Well, you see, yes, indeed, and you see, the thing is that that's all nonsense. He's just trying to create a cover. This is the cover narrative for MKUltra.
Yeah.
Now he says, "Well, we're looking at the future of illegal drugs to help people. We want to help people."
Well, like, a good example. One of those underground chemists. An example would be like Owsley Stanley, right?
Yeah, there's an underground chemist. Right. So we want to know everything, and so. And also the timing is so important because he's so proud of the fact they were 13 years ahead of the epidemic. I mean, this is like 10 years ahead of where the first experimentation was being done in South America. So you can see that this is a Jolly West production. They hit the jackpot in terms of taking the souls out of human beings with crack, and then they targeted a specific group. At the same time, they were giving them 100-to-1 sentencing to make sure that none of all the black males could be separated. And they would just put the family out of it. Being even a traditional, there's no tradition of family members at all. It's just prison life, thug life,
single. And those in the know could invest in the American Correctional Corporation.
Yes, that's right. Which is a huge
Correctional Corporation of America. I mean, because you
right. could, because yeah, because you know you're going to have like. Millions of these kids are going to stuff in there. But the thing is that at the same time, the powder cocaine is still, now the pornographic white male is cocaine is still available there. Mm-hmm. And there's no real, unless you have 500 grams, which I mean, just no one's going to have that. It's just there's no chance that you're going to do any prison time. So, they bifurcate the penalties, but it's done as all part of the process that they're engaged in, and that's why I said that I think that this show is sort of like the end of a trilogy, where you have Martin Luther King, Great Society, and now Gary Webb's expose of cocaine, which has now enabled at this point the rock to get turned over. And what you see is not the Contras. It's not, rough American, guys trying to fight commies. It is the destruction of the black family.
Yeah, of course, an important aspect of the story of Gary Webb is how his career was ruined and then how he died.
Yeah.
For his investigative journalism, he was run out of the business. I mentioned that as many as 17 reporters were assigned him at the Los Angeles Times, but there was a program, and it was, let me see here. Yeah, it was called Managing a Nightmare, CIA Public Affairs and the Drug Conspiracy Story. And apparently the CIA was apparently caught off guard when the story broke, like we said, probably because of San Jose Mercury News' innovative use of the internet at the time.
Yeah.
But the agency found that the major newspapers, the Washington Post, New York Times, LA Times, many reporters were more than willing to help the CIA criticize Gary Webb's work and marginalize it or cover it up. And I'm reading an article about it and suggests that the CIA has, because of their longstanding relationship with so many reporters, they didn't even have to ask. It just happened. Well, yeah. I mean, we all know about Operation Mockingbird.
And, right. And it was like the LA Times and the Washington Post was right in.
And what they didn't like was, and this is, I think, a part of it is that the San Jose Mercury News is a small market. And the fact that they would break this story, or at least have such an impact. Well, the news is determined by the national news, the New York Times. They make the news. All the news is fit to print. They're not going to be scooped by a small newspaper. And that, so they were more than willing to suppress the story and crush his career. Gary Webb, I think, one time gave a speech where he said, for years I was promoted. I got awards. All the time I was reporting on stories that didn't matter. The moment I reported a story that mattered, my career ended.
Right.
That's the reality. And that's the reality of investigative journalism. It's all controlled. And he seemed to lament the demise of investigative journalism. I don't think there ever was a golden era of investigative journalism because the media, the mainstream media, the major newspapers have always been a tool of the oligarchs and the secret societies that they belong to. And so what happened was, when a story does break like this, does cause some trouble, ruffle some feathers, and reveal some truth about the true nature of the system, he had to be destroyed. And of course, there is some question regarding his death too.
I was going to say that I think the two bullet to the head suicide, that's actually a message. They're basically telling anyone else interested in that kind of investigative reporting that you too can have a suicide with two bullets to the head.
Yes.
I mean, it was so ludicrous, the idea that this particular guy who's, so much involved in exposing the CIA would have that kind of suicide. I mean,
there was a conversation, someone had a tape conversation he had with a guy named John Rowland, and Gary Webb said, if I ever wind up dead and it said it's a suicide, it won't be a suicide because I'm not going to kill myself. Then they cite the fact that he was, he had been divorced, he had some financial setbacks, and it's always easy to do to someone. It's just easy to break up someone's marriage and ruin their career. So you can say, well, he was down on his luck. Of course he was down on his luck because he was run out of business. But some people claim that he had actually enough information. He was about to publish a new book with some new material, and the manuscript and his notes went missing after his death. So that was never produced.
Yeah, but I'm just going to ask a question. How many suicides are able to get off a second shot?
Well, they say it's possible. I don't see. I mean, if you don't do it right the first time, I don't think you're in a state to.
Man, you've got to have a lot of willpower.
Yeah.
You know.
And he claimed that he was like being followed and all that. He like people climbing up his house at night. And I can see that type of harassment, that type of human targeting or something, or, where someone's being harassed. That's very easy to drive. That's almost like what what he went through is almost like what the Stasi did to people in East Germany. It's called disintegration, where you marginalize someone by deprive them of their livelihood. And pretty soon people know that he's radioactive, so he no longer has any friends, and break up their marriage. And you drive him to the state where either they commit suicide or they are suicided. And it's, like I said, it's two bullets to the head. It's like, really? Okay. I suppose it's possible, not impossible. Well, but
I mean, I just look at that as a message. I mean, obviously killed him, and they called it a suicide, but they put the second bullet out just as a way of letting, anyone who's curious, to like, and thinking about doing similar exposés, you're going to get killed. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is you know, I mean, that's...
Well, look what happened to Michael Hastings. Apparently he had a drinking problem or a past substance abuse problem, so his car blows up.
Right, just blows up. I know. Okay,
And who was the other guy? Daniel Casolaro, who was the octopus, who wound up dead in a hotel in West Virginia. And he was investigating what he called the octopus. And that tied into a lot of, actually, some of what Gary Webb was talking, the drug running, the arms shipments and these things. And he was getting into some of that stuff, human trafficking. And who knows what he had unleashed. But he went to go meet a source in a town in West Virginia and then ended up committing suicide, cutting his wrists. And, and they found, apparently the police, when they found out that their towels bunched up with blood, and apparently he hated blood, so it was very unlikely that'd be why he would commit suicide. But,
well, there's safety in numbers. I just wanted to mention that, people want to fight against the system. One thing is needed is numbers. Mm-hmm. Safety is in numbers. I mean, I hope our show spawns 100 shows, 1,000 shows, because that's what we need to do. I mean, we've had problems with YouTube, which Tim now is basically only posting a few minutes of the show on YouTube so that we don't, permit ourselves to be censored by them. But we need everyone. We can overwhelm YouTube, I think, if we have enough people using that venue in the right way, trying to get this kind of information out. So that's something that I would hope people can do. I also hope that, in the comments that because Webb's information is still online, which is quite a tribute.
Yes.
It's kind of a wonderful thing. You can actually go there and read the source material that Webb was using to show that there was some kind of involvement between cocaine and the CIA. And then I think just analytically, once you get to, kind of the material that we're presenting here, you don't have any questions. It's just as clear as a bell. They created a kind of, as clear as a bell to me anyway, they created a limited hangout that they could fall back to so that people wouldn't understand that the Children of the Great Society program were being targeted, the males. And that's who they went after, and they just slaughtered them. I mean, they put millions in prison and then, of course, created a culture of crime now that it's going to take generations to get out of. But how can they do it? How can the African-American community, which was fragile to begin with, it was the most fragile American community, which is why it was targeted. How can it reverse course? Well, information. You got to get the particularly young people to know that they were targeted, and that the culture that they basically feel they need to idolize, the gang life culture, that this was a weapon against them. It's going to be tough, but it has to start with information.
Yeah, and they can't look for the government for help, because
right,
the government can do everything to you. The government that you want to do everything for you will do what it wants to you.
Yeah, and this is a great example.
Yeah,
is at first you get the welfare check, and this is all being supported, and black politicians are making careers off of increasing government largesse to single women. But once the check comes in the mail, there's something that also comes in the mail, and that's control. You don't see the control.
Yeah, with the white majority, the middle class, it's been a more of a gradual approach. One thing is, they just created an economic environment where the one earner, male father earner, primary earner, woman homemaker is no longer feasible. Now the children are effectively institutionalized, warehoused, and then pretty soon, a generation later, you can create things like transgenderism.
and
forms families anymore.
And people who think that, this is like going to be wonderful in the brave new world of, onsets, and we get rid of the patriarchal white male's domination in families. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd be wise to look at the crack cocaine epidemic.
Yeah.
Because this is really where you're headed. I mean, the people who are the victims of crack cocaine, they and the autistic children are the ones who are really the brave new world. They're the future. That's what you're being taken into. When you see Jolly West creating this, and then Siegel testifying to Congress that cocaine is fine, not a problem, the benefits outweigh the risks, and then you listen to his his disclosures, you are just dealing with incredible evil. I mean, this is evil on a scale that, literally has never been seen before on the planet, and it's very well organized. And so, you have to fight back by trying to reverse their programs. You know, you have to bring back families, bring back morality, bring back modesty. Everything that they've given you has been designed to destroy you. And, you know, it's always given like, like Herbert Marcuse, right, with, Eros and Civilization, where, look, we just want you to have more fun. We want you to have more sex. We want you to have polysex. We mm-hmm. want you to, do your own thing. And drugs are fine, too. You know.
And, of course, this started out with Time Life, 1957, which you tied back to MKUltra. Another example how MKUltra functioned, it doesn't just CIA. It fans out into banking and publishing, and it's J.P. Morgan. It's Time Life, Henry Luce empire. And to Life Magazine, which is in every dentist office, is an article how cool it is to take psychedelic drugs and these things. And at the same time, it's promoting youth culture. That's how you create the culture that was unleashed, or at least the cultural revolution that was unleashed in the 1960s and beyond.
Yeah, and at the time, we couldn't defend ourselves. No one
can imagine that type of coordination or organization. That's just not
that level of evil.
Yeah.
You know, that some group would say, we're going to genocide a whole generation of a particular ethnicity, right? Mm-hmm. That would go after, like, and this is a really important, I think that's why one thing's really important about the crack epidemic is that their focus is on a particular ethnicity. See, this is, they understand that ethnicity is a power, and this is something they have to destroy. So, here they went after, basically the remnants of the black family. But when you look at the, Gordon Wasson's article in Life magazine, May 1957, you can mm-hmm. see them going after the white middle class, right? They're going after everybody that isn't in the tribe.
Yes.
You know? And so what do we got to do? Well, we have to organize. We have to promote an information revolution. We just have to know that this is being done to us. That's a first step. It's got to be very, very widespread. We have, because they are in control of the media. So when you look at Trump versus Hillary, you fall into the trap of thinking this is some sort of a real world situation. This is just the theatrical pageant that is being presented in front of you to distract you. It's mm-hmm. a distraction. It's not real. What's real is the secret society that manipulates these things. And if you can see them, if you can look up from Hillary and the Donald and through the strings and see the secret society, then you can take some steps to defend yourself.
Yeah, and characters like Blandone, Ricky Ross,
Menendez.
They're just playing their part in it. I remember there's a Terry Reid's book, Compromised. He gets into some of the stuff about Iran-Contra, and he was a true believer, Cold War. He was involved in some of the MENA operation. And if you want to understand, again, if you doubt this, just look into the life and career of Barry Seal. Explain that to me.
Yes.
I want a normie to explain that to me. It's just look into Barry Seal. Just look into Barry Seal and his connections. They go, but anyway, how he was working with Barry Seal, Terry Reid. He kind of blew the whistle, and they chased him for a year and a half. And he apparently beat them because he knew some of the techniques, apparently, of how to avoid detection because he was an old operator. But anyway, he was talking to a Israeli agent who was involved in some of the gun running into Central America about what was going on. And this time Terry Reid's getting a little skeptical about it. None of it seems to make any sense. Is why are we doing all this? What, you know, we send the arms down there and the drugs come and the drugs buy the money to get the arms, send the arms down there. All it does is just create problems, start civil wars. He says, and the guy said, well, this is what we do. This is our, at our level, this is the, how the game is played. It's a business. And just start, you create these arenas of instability. You create demand for arms, which facilitates the shipment of drugs and other things out of that country, and then you just feed it and feed it back and forth. And you'll need an excuse or pretext like the Cold War to justify it. You know.
Yeah. And yeah. And you insert something like Castro, then you can have the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
Everyone's ducking, covering. We have to give more power.
Castro, who was put in the power by the CIA.
Right. We have to then have a technologic slave snooping state so that the commies don't blow us up. I mean, so everything has to be looked at. If it's terror, the question is, you know, who benefits from them? You have to try and look at it that way. And if it's someone that comes at you like, I want to give you a worker's paradise, right? I mean, like the Great Society programs. The question is, well, who are you? You know, and particularly when they're asking for power and control, you have to ask the question, who are you? You have to vet that. Who controls you? Because we can prove the secret society exists. We can prove a lot of their techniques. And so we should be able to develop some ability in the public to be able to discern lifetime actors so that we can see that, wait a second, you know, Gloria Steinem seems like it's going to be terrific for us women. We're going to have all of this freedom. But wait a second, who is she? You know, who does she represent? Who mm-hmm. pulls her strings? What is she involved with? And when it, you know, goes back to the same tribe that is manning, Jolly West, Dr. Mengele Plus, well, you don't move into the worker's paradise that Gloria Steinem is setting up. You stop and you think, wait a second, you know, is this being done just for the purpose ultimately of enslavement and control?
Yeah, because these revolutionaries all have corporate backing or government backing.
Yeah, that's the first thing you have to like wonder about, you know. It's like, so anyway, I think that...
Here's a magazine, Gloria. Have at it.
Right.
Oh, you're really going against the system, Gloria.
Yeah, a real rebel. Yeah, just a rebel. Yeah, and then the CIA is this like bunch of really wonderful liberal men like Jolly West.
Mm-hmm.
Jolly West using like experiments on children using cattle prods. You know, I mean, we could do a whole show on Jolly West, but he is just Mengele plus, and it's just, you know, I mean, even the, you know, the experiment that Huxley told him to do is. That it just shows that basically human life is irrelevant to him and to the secret organization, obviously, because the idea of like hypnotizing someone and then giving them LSD to see if you can control their behavior, you can't be sure you're not going to create psychosis. How would you be positive about that?
Yeah.
You can't do an experiment like that if you have any concern for the humanity whatsoever of the victim, of the person you're going to work this thing on. So you have to be beyond that, right? You're beyond caring. You're into this idea of like, kill them all.
Oh, there was that early experiment with that French town, you know, where they dosed the entire town and tried to blame it on bread mold or something.
Yeah, and again, this is the same group that then went ahead with the youth revolution for the white kids and crack cocaine for the African Americans.
Yeah.
You know, so it's it's a dangerous world, and it's dangerous because not the world is dangerous, but the secret society wants to murder you.
Yeah.
So you need to take action against them. And I hope that I got a lot of response from both the Martin Luther King and the show we did on the Great Society from African Americans. And I'm hoping that this will be the same, that the trilogy will become something that might be valuable to them as far as just understanding how they got here, and hopefully understanding it, they can then take some steps to start moving away from the brave new world mm-hmm. gangster culture that they've been led into.
Yep. Okay, Joe.
Tim, been great talking to you. Hey, next week, We're gonna do Jeffrey Epstein, right?
Yeah, let's talk about that and maybe some more unfold. There's a lot of angles. There's the intelligence angle. There's the human compromise and all these things.
Looking forward to that, and maybe we should. You want to take a trip to Little St. James? You and I, and like maybe spend a couple of days there, hanging out, seeing what they're up to.
I'll just get a back rub. Well, I shouldn't joke about it, but
I know it's
sick. But Alan, I like Alan Dershowitz. You just got a back rub.
Yeah, Alan. Well, anyway, we'll be after those guys next week. Thank you very much, and I'll talk to you next week, Tim.
Okay, talk to you. Bye bye.
All right, bye bye. Thank you.